In part by Cranard Center for the Performing Arts. During the weeks ahead, enjoy musical performances by the Munich Symphony Orchestra and the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra with violinist Sarah Chang. For more information, contact the Cranard Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit CranardCenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of the Chancellor, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give and how your donations will help our community is on the web at www.ccfd.uiuc.edu.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and this is the WILL Fall Membership Campaign. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon, and if you've contributed to the campaign, thank you. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our goal this week is to begin raising the funds to pay for programs like the Afternoon Magazine. As a listener-supported public radio station, we count on you to help us do that. We have a dollar goal for this drive of $160,000 today. By the end of the day today, we hope to be at $70,000. Here with me in the studio to help me urge you on to the telephone and give us a call of support, a pledge of financial support, AM 580 news reporter Jim Meadows. Jim?
Thanks, Celeste. And, you know, we know that many of you listening right now listen to AM 580 for an hour or two each day. That's just your regular listening pattern. Well, that's 10 to 12 hours per week, 500 to 600 hours per year, a lot of time. And $120 would be a small price to pay when you consider the information and inspiration and companionship you get from AM 580. It only takes a couple of minutes to give, 2 minutes right now to make a pledge. Hundreds of hours of great radio in the months to come. So please make the call now to 217-244-9455, that's 244-9455, or give online at willpledge.org. Allison Davis Wood, the host of Prairie Fire and WILL TV, is over at Pledge Central right now, and she's been monitoring how the calls are coming in, especially with new contributors.
Yes, Jim, and we are looking forward to having some more phones ring. We really appreciate everyone that's called in today and made a pledge to WILL. We really do thank you for your support, and we would like to make a special appeal to those of you who might be new friends of WILL. We have got 94 new members so far, but we have a goal of 500 new members for this radio drive. And I know that there's people out there, maybe you turn it on in the morning, check in on the weather, you turn it on at your workplace and listen to David and Celeste, or on your drive home, you're listening to what the news happened during the day while you were at work, and maybe you've never gotten around to making a pledge. Well, now is the time to do that, and we really need to hear from you so that we continue with all the wonderful programming here on AM 580. It's very easy to do. All you have to do is go to the phone, call it 217-244-9455. We have volunteers standing by to take your pledge. We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. And maybe you're just going to think about it for a while and you want to do it a little later. You can always call the WLLpledge.org. You can make a pledge on our website. I can do that at any time. So we're here to take your pledges, and we really need to hear from you. At the $40 basic membership level, you can get a subscription to Patterns Magazine so you can keep track of all the programs on both of our radio stations and the TV station. And also, we have another incentive if you are someone who is a new member, someone who has never pledged to WILL before. Our friends over at World Harvest Foods, Hazim and Mustafa, would send you a $10 gift certificate to their store. And it is an amazing selection of foods from around the world. I have to say, one of my favorites are the milk chocolate hobnobs, the tea biscuits that you can get there. So I would highly recommend those, and $10 would buy you a lot of those, believe me. So let's hear from some people out there who I know are enjoying the programming today, and I'm really looking forward to catching up with one of my childhood friends, Nancy Drew.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Allison. We'll check in with you again later this afternoon to see how things are progressing. Again, that number to call with a pledge of financial support, 244-9455, 217, the area code, 244-WILL. And as Allison mentioned, you can pledge online at any time, willpledge, that's WILL pledge.org. org. And our thanks as well to Jim Meadows. We'll check back with him a little later this afternoon as well. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. The first Nancy Drew mystery appeared in 1930. 80 million books later, she's still going strong. She's an American icon. Nancy Drew was invented by dime novel creator Edward Stratemeyer. She was brought to life by two women, a journalist by the name of Mildred Wirt Benson and Edward Stratemeyer's daughter, Harriet Stratemeyer Adams. On the program today, a look at Nancy Drew and the women who created her and what Nancy Drew has meant to generations of American girls and women. Our guest this afternoon, Melanie Rahak. She's the author of Girl Sleuth, Nancy Drew and the Women Who Created Her. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. Join us with your questions, your comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Melanie Rahak is a critic and poet. Her essays have appeared in several magazines, including the New York Times Magazine and Vogue. Her poetry has been published in the New York Times and the Paris Review. And she read the Nancy Drew mysteries voraciously as a girl. Girl Sleuth is Melanie's first book. The publisher is Harcourt. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. 553-333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Melanie, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you recall the first Nancy Drew mystery you read?
Yes, I do, because it remained, of course, one of my longstanding favorites. It was The Mystery of the Tolling Bell, which is a great, very spooky mystery that involves a cave that floods and a bell that rings in the cave that it is believed is being rung by a very terrifying ghost. And of course, it's up to Nancy and her chums, but mostly Nancy, to figure out what's happening behind all of these strange goings-on.
Who tipped you to Nancy Drew as a girl? Was it something you discovered on your own, or was it your mom or a friend?
No, it was actually, well, I had an older sister who had read the books, and of course, being the younger sister, I wanted to do everything she had done. And our mother before us, who, like Mildred Wirt Benson, the first ghostwriter of the series, grew up in Iowa and read the books in the 40s. So we have, like many families, I think, a tradition of Nancy Drew amongst the women in our family.
Well, tell us about how you kept managing to read Nancy Drew after your parents said, lights out.
Well, like any good reader of Nancy Drew, you know, I was able to come up with many good themes and plots for continuing to read after Lights Out. And my particular plan was to pretend that I was afraid of the dark, which I wasn't, I'm happy to say, but to convince my parents that I was too afraid to go to sleep without the light on in the hall outside of my bedroom. And then I would flip over to the end of my bed and hang off it and hold my Nancy Drew book into the sort of sliver of light that came in from the hall through the almost closed door and, you know, literally hang until the blood rushed to my head and just keep reading and keep reading and keep reading until I either finished or just couldn't bear to go on.
So. Yeah. I think Nancy Drew would approve.
Yes.
She would have
so
approved. I suspect there may be some listeners with us this afternoon who could tell you that Nancy Drew is a character, a young woman in books popular with girls, and they could tell you that she solves mysteries. But maybe that's about it. What else should they know? What else would you like to say about Nancy Drew?
Well, I think, you know, one of the most important things about her, certainly right now, this is her 75th anniversary, and it's to think about why she has stayed with us for so long. I mean, there have been any number of other detective series and even other girls detectives, but she really has had more lasting power than anybody. And I think, you know, certainly she solved mysteries. That was her main function. That was the plot of every story. But it was really how she did it and who she was that made her and still make her such an icon. She is an incredibly resourceful character. She's constantly getting into situations, you know, that are horrifying and scary, and she really relies on her own intelligence, which I think is an immensely appealing quality. She is not enthralled to anybody. She certainly for readers who are children, she has the amazing ability to always be right, and adults always pay attention to what she has to say, which I think is something that we all long for as children. You know, you just are dying for some adult to turn to you and say, well, what do you think about that? And, of course, it never happens. So, you know, to see her in that situation over and over again, I think is very empowering for children. I know it certainly was for me. So, you know, I think there's a lot more to her than just the fact that she solved mysteries, although, of course, the mysteries are always wonderful and, you know, involve lots of spooky locales and bad guys and things like that.
Yeah. What do girls learn from Nancy Drew?
I think they learn how to be independent, and I think that they learn that they don't need a boyfriend or, you know, another male figure to tell them what to do. I mean, Nancy, as I'm sure readers who are listening know, has a long-suffering boyfriend named Ned Nickerson, who came into the series in 1932 and has kind of been around ever since. But he is very much a secondary character, and he's sort of there to provide Nancy with a little bit of social life, but he often gets in the way, and he is always trying to convince her that she shouldn't pursue a mystery because it's too dangerous, or she shouldn't take a trip because, you know, he doesn't want her to go away for so long, and she just sort of brushes him off. And I think, you know, that's a great lesson to learn for girls, that it's not all about how to catch a man and thinking about getting married. I think, you know, they learn that it's okay to be smart, which is still not a popular idea, I think, among young girls and adolescent girls, because certainly Nancy relies on her wits and her intelligence over and over again. And they learn, you know, how to be a good person. Nancy's a very good citizen, I think, in many ways, other than just her crime solving. And I think those are all important lessons.
And she also has all kinds of talents. She could be a stunt driver.
Yes, she does.
She climbs, she swims, she plays golf. And, you know, here's something interesting as well. All this physical activity.
Yes. I think one of the reasons she was very revolutionary when the books first came out in 1930 was that she was very athletic, and she has remained so. And she was athletic without being, you know, a tomboy. She combined sort of the ladylike aspects of the 30s, you know, and the way she dressed and her smart suits and her party frocks, but she is an excellent swimmer, and she's an excellent horsewoman, and she drives her own car, which is, you know, really a big deal and a big key to her independence. And, you know, I think that was a fairly radical idea for that time. Athletics for women were just sort of coming into vogue kind of in the 20s, and, you know, there she was showing how if you were stuck out in a rowboat in a lightning storm, you know, with a panicky friend and your boat capsized, well, it was really important to be a good swimmer because it was up to you to rescue your friend and, you know, make everything work out okay. So I think, she, you know, that's a huge part of her appeal also, the athleticism.
Yeah. Let's go back and talk about adults, and they listen to Nancy, and her father treats her in such a fashion. But she's missing a mother. She's motherless. How old was Nancy when her mother died? And do you think that contributes to the appeal of the story somehow and to what Nancy is able to accomplish?
Yes, I certainly think it does. She was 3 when her mother died, so she's a girl who really has grown up without her mother entirely. And I think, I mean, certainly that has long been an important aspect of many popular children's books, that the children are either orphaned or semi-orphaned, the way Nancy is, and thus have to, you know, make their way in the world a little bit more maybe than a child who would be more sheltered by parents. I also think that in Nancy's case, it allows her to be a grown-up in a way. She is the mistress of her household. She's described in that way, you know, many times in the early books. And, you know, she's the one in charge of the wonderful housekeeper, Hannah Groon, and her father defers to her on, you know, sort of all domestic matters. And I think it, you know, it allows her to not only be an adult within her home, but, you know, it certainly contributes to her independence and, you know, just the fact that she doesn't have a mother at home telling her that she can't go out in the outfit she's wearing or she has to stay home and clean up her room. I mean, she's sort of, you know, beyond all of that, and it makes it, I think, all the more plausible then that she's allowed to go off to, you know, all these strange places and solve mysteries. That sort of influence on her has been removed, and so she's at once sort of mature for her age and also, you know, free of the shackles that having a mother might put on her.
Yeah, and Ned Nickerson, the character in the books who tries to put a brake on things, he's a peer, so she can tell him.
Right, exactly.
Later.
Exactly, and there's also sort of always the implication that Nancy's just maybe a little bit smarter than Ned, you know, and we need to keep that in mind at all times. He's a nice guy, and her father approves of him, but, you know, really, she's the smart one. So,
what else would you like to say? What would you like to say about the other ancillary characters, but who are also central in a way?
Right.
Bess, her cousin Bess, and her friend George.
Right. Bess and George, the three of them sort of form this trio, this kind of fascinating power structure in which Nancy is, of course, always on top. And Bess is sort of the giggly, slightly timid one. She's a little bit boy crazy. And George, as her name implies, is the tomboy and the very athletic one and the one who, you know, never wants to talk about dates or anything like that, and she's sort of fearless. She's often the one that goes along with Nancy on the more harrowing escapades. And I think, you know, not only do you get to see the three of them as a sort of unit, but Bess and George are other ways into the series for girls. You know, Nancy's a very perfect character. She's a character that a lot of girls aspire to be like, or they want her as their friend, but she's maybe a little bit too perfect to really relate to. And so you have these other two who are her friends that I think make readers feel like, well, you know, if they're not going to be everything that Nancy Drew is, they certainly are either just like Bess or just like George, and there's definitely a place for them in this, you know, magical world of River Heights where mysteries are always solved. So, and they're really kind of wonderful characters. George, I'm particularly fond of her. She's, you know, a little bit grumpy and you know, prone to sort of saying cranky things, and she says hypers a lot when she's worried about something, which has become kind of her famous catch line. And, you know, Bess is sort of this wonderfully sweet character. So, I think they work very well as a threesome, and, you know, they provide a lot of doors into the series.
Hmm. Melanie Rahak is our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Girl Sleuth, Nancy Drew, and the Women Who Created Her. And we're going to get around to that very important topic in just a moment. But a little bit more background on Nancy Drew, this character. She appears in 1930 in the Depression. And Nancy Drew is a wealthy young woman. She has a car. She has a wardrobe. And so on and so forth. And in your introduction to the book, you know, you say she's as American as slumber parties, homework, and bubblegum. And here's something that I've wondered. Has she been popular primarily with the middle and upper class girls, or was reading about someone who had some money in the Depression, was that a comfort?
I think the latter. I think she was then, and she remains very popular with all kinds of girls. I mean, in a way, it was sort of a great accident of fate that she was first published during the Depression. She actually was sought up by Edward Stratemeyer before the stock market crash, and so I think she was just sort of another, you know, well-to-do girl, of which he had created many. But the fact that she made her debut at this time when so many Americans were feeling so desperate, and I think, you know, I mean, certainly I don't want to assume anything, but I can imagine that as a parent during that time, one of your big concerns would be not only the welfare of your children, but just the idea that your children were being shown the world as an ugly and frightening place. And, you know, here there were these books that cost only 50 cents and which often were passed around among friends where they could escape into another world, a world where everyone had what they needed. And, you know, not only that, but there was a character their own age who had everything she needed. And I think she provided a lot of solace in that way, readers who were not experiencing the same things in their own lives. And of course she's very gracious about all of it, you know, which makes her a great role model in that way too. So,
and she's also a person who is generous and giving of her time, mm-hmm. to charitable organizations.
Right.
Yeah. Outside of that, have the mysteries dealt directly or indirectly with economic standing, with class, with race over the years?
Well, they have had a sort of troubled history with all of those things. I mean, it's certainly a feature of the early books from the 30s and 40s especially that they are filled with some very bad, you know, racial and ethnic prejudices, which were unfortunately very common for the time. And certainly they are often set up around a class structure. It's very clear that Nancy is from the upper class and that all the criminals she goes after are these sort of lower class people, often foreign or of a different ethnic background than her. And I think, you know, it's something that the series had a lot of trouble with. The books were all revised starting in the late 1950s, and they knew that these things had to be removed, but they weren't quite sure how to deal with it. And so what they actually did was just to take all of those characters out and not replace them. And I think because the books have always been set in a fictional world and have not addressed not only race and class issues, but really sort of current events, major things happening in American history when they were being written, there was not a good way for the Stratemeyer Syndicate to introduce, you know, the complexities of things like race and class into these books. So certainly that is something that a lot of people have taken issue with over the years. But, you know, I think arguably Nancy Drew books are not the right place to go for, you know, the discussion of those kinds of things. And certainly there are lots of other children's books, wonderful children's books out there that do deal with them head on.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions. Comments also invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You note in the book, Melanie, that the books you read as a child in the 1970s were not the ones your mom had read, even when the title was the same. Would you tell us about some of the changes Nancy Drew has undergone over the years?
Sure. Yes. The books that I read for the most part were the revisions that I just mentioned in answer to the last question. And, of course, the new ones that were still being written in the 60s and 70s. And yes, Nancy has certainly undergone many changes since 1930. There have been the kind of superficial ones. Her clothing was updated, her slang, her car went from the famous blue roadster to a blue convertible, and later a Mustang, and now she's actually driving a blue hybrid car. So There were all those kinds of changes. And her character also has had some fluctuations. I mean, certainly she's always been the independent, intelligent, you know, girl that we love. But depending on who was writing her, she was shaded in slightly different ways. And in the early books, when Mildred Ward Benson was writing her, when she was so athletic and kind of brash, those were very much reflections of who Mildred Ward Benson was. She was actually herself an excellent swimmer and a champion diver, and she really felt that this new, strong girl character should embody the things that she felt were useful to her as a girl and a woman, kind of making it into man's world. And then when Harriet Adams took over first the editing of the books and later the writing of them, she changed Nancy to reflect a little bit more what she thought were the necessary qualities of a modern young American woman. And Harriet was a very different kind of woman from Mildred in the sense that she had grown up in a very privileged household and gone to Wellesley and sort of relied a bit more on her feminine wiles and felt that, you know, often the way to get things as a woman was to take a back seat a little bit and, you know, get them slightly more surreptitiously than Mildred believed. And Mildred was really kind of a hard hitter. So, you know, Nancy has definitely, she reflects those things. And if you look at the later books versus the older books, you can see the changes. But, I mean, I think really the most critical thing is that her core, the qualities that make her so brave and independent, have not changed. And those were certainly things that both Mildred and Harriet in common.
Let's talk with a listener, a caller in Dalton, Illinois, on line four. Hi.
Hi, I have a question. Who is Carolyn Keene?
These two women that we're talking about were both Carolyn Keene.
Oh.
Mildred Benson was the first Carolyn Keene until the early 1950s, and Harriet Adams then took it over, and she was Carolyn Keene until she died in 1982.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that was a...
I'm so glad you called.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Thanks for the call. Yeah, I should have provided that information.
Yes, that Carolyn Keene was a pen name. In fact, I don't know. It's very risky to tell people that because there are still a lot of people, you know, even getting up in their years, who just are crushed by the idea that there is no Carolyn Keene. I think she... in a way, has as much of a place in you know, American pop culture as Nancy Drew herself does, because I think there were so many little girls who loved not only the idea of Nancy, but the idea of the woman who was sitting at a desk somewhere writing these books.
Writing them just for us.
Exactly.
Why the pen name?
That was Stratemeyer Syndicate standard procedure. Edward Stratemeyer thought of many, many series that were very popular. He was behind the Hardy Boys and the Rover Boys and Tom Swift and the Dana Girls and, you know, just pretty much any series you can think of from the 20th century that had any kind of longevity or made any impression, he thought of. But before he founded his company, he was writing all of these books himself, and he literally couldn't keep up with his own ideas, so he hatched this plan to write outlines for his series and give them to ghostwriters and have the ghostwriters write under a pen name, and then he would edit all of the books for consistency. And he knew that the most important thing, especially for children who were reading, was loyalty to the series and the author, and he wanted to ensure that if he lost one of his ghostwriters for whatever reason, he would be able to replace the writer without letting the fans know that it was somebody different, and that he would be able to make sure that the books continued on in a consistent style with his own editing. So Carolyn Keene was actually just one in a long line of pen names that he came up with.
Mm. And Carolyn Keene got a lot of mail, didn't she?
Yes, she did get a lot of mail. Lots of letters about what girls thought Nancy should be doing or not doing, or letters about mysteries that they had solved, you know, in their own towns, you know, anger when things didn't go the way they thought they should in an Nancy Drew mystery. And sometimes, I think maybe most touchingly, girls wrote into Carolyn Keene with their problems. I think they really looked to her as, you know, kind of somebody who could help them the way that she had helped Nancy get through all of these troubles that she got into.
Hmm. Let me invite other listeners to join us this afternoon. Questions, comments, they're invited. Your participation is really important here on the Afternoon Magazine. Look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. 333-9455, excuse me, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, that's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. So interesting reading about Stratemeyer, Edward Stratemeyer. What an interesting character he was.
Yeah, he was.
So prolific. When he came up with the idea for Nancy Drew, he'd been writing for children for more than 40 years. And in the 1890s, between May of 1892 and November of 1893, he produced 42 dime novels. This is, at the close of the 19th century and into the 20th century. In the course of your research for this book, what did you learn about the emergence of stories printed in broadsheets, magazines, and books for young readers?
Well, Edward Stratemeyer really, he collided perfectly with the moment in American history when children were being sort of discovered as readers and later on discovered as, you know, an audience that could be marketed to. So really when he started out, most stories for children were being published in religious magazines and papers, and very slowly, what was called children's story papers started to emerge, and from that it was a pretty fast leap to dime novels, which are sort of the predecessor to serious books like Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys. And there just was sort of an endless appetite for these books. Children had never really had anything of their own to read. They had never had anything fun to read, so they just gobbled them up, and of course because they cost 10 cents, you know, it was perfect for a kid with allowance. And Edward Stratemeyer's first successful series was The Rover Boys, and after that he just took off, and he was sort of one publisher referred to him as the grand old man of the 50 center, which was the price for all of his books. And he really was sort of known as the godfather of this whole genre. So it was really fascinating for me, especially having been such an avid reader as a child, to look at this moment in history when children as readers were really born. And to realize, you know, it's such a foreign idea to us now that there was a time when children were not catered to with books or magazines or anything like that. It seems very strange to think about it. It's such a huge market now, and we all understand so much now about how important it is for children to read for so many reasons. But to kind of witness through my research this thrilling, you know, progression was really interesting. And certainly studying Edward Stratemeyer was a great way to get to it.
Yeah. Would it be accurate to say that the latter half of the 19th century or the late 19th century was when children might have been at a point where they actually had, children actually had leisure time?
Yes, that was just starting also at the end of the 19th century and certainly, you know, into the beginning of the 20th. I think, you know, along with the idea of children and reading was this new idea that children were not just little adults who, you know, should be working. Them enrollment in school rose dramatically in those years, and schools also began to get involved in what kids were reading. And, you know, just the idea of childhood as a time in one's life when, you know, there should be a little bit of freedom and frivolity was just starting to emerge. So it all kind of happened right at that moment. Mm-hmm. So it was a perfect moment for somebody like Edward Stratemeyer to come along.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. Yeah, I was raised on the Hardy Boys, and what intrigued me, I used to collect, you know, the older books, and I noticed that several prominent titles got rewrites around the 40s,
mm-hmm.
maybe, and I guess became more, I don't know, politically correct, or, well, I won one title in particular, The Disappearing Floor, the entire plot changed. The original version in the 30s was more of a sci-fi version, and the rewrite was totally different.
Right.
You know, so I didn't know if Nancy Drew had anything, you know, similar to that.
Yes, or... yes. There, certainly the rewrites of the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew started around the same time, and there were absolutely cases in which entire plots of books were just gutted out and gotten rid of because they either were not politically correct anymore, as you said, or just because, you know, children's sophistication had progressed to the point where, you know, it was no longer that exciting that the Hardy Boys, you know, went in an airplane somewhere or something
right,
like that.
Right.
So they had to kind of start over from scratch, but they didn't want to change the titles because they didn't, they didn't want to lose
well,
the readers.
Intrigued not to, well, it was probably a couple of years ago, I received a mailing from, I forget the, they sold a lot of various, you know, novelty items, and they boasted that they were recreating the original Hardy Boys before the PC
mm-hmm.
rewrites. Is there anything like that with Nancy Drew that you know of?
Or? Yes, there is. Actually, there's a small press in Massachusetts called Applewood Books that is reissuing all of the original Nancy Drews with the original text and the original jacket art, which is really wonderful. So.
That might be something. Look, I've got a daughter that... You know, we can read the modern ones, but it might be neat to obtain the older. And I don't know if I want to burst anyone's bubble out there. I still remember the day I learned that Franklin W. Dixon was a woman.
Yes, that was another famous Stratemeyer pen name.
So. Oh, yes. So, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call
thank
this
you.
Afternoon. My crushing moment came when I was watching Peter Pan on television and my mother told me Mary Martin was Peter Pan.
Well,
like,
we all
no.
have those moments. There's a great interview that Mildred Benson did about 8 or 9 years before she died where the interviewer told her that she had gone home to her mother and said, you know, there's no Carolyn Keene, and her mother had just been completely horrified, and Mildred chastised this reporter, and she said, you know, you can't tell people that. It's like telling them there's no Santa Claus. So I've always loved that story, you know, that it's akin to destroying this great
yeah.
myth.
Yeah. Before we have to wrap up, tell us a little bit about these two women who were so different, who wrote these books. They're different, yet somehow or other, they had the same spirit, I would say.
Mm-hmm. They both were amazing women. Mildred Augustine, what's her maiden name, was born in the tiny little town in Iowa in 1905, a town of about 300 people, and she was the daughter of a doctor, and she was a tomboy who loved to read, and she knew that she was going to be a writer from sort of, you know, the moment she could speak. And she went on to the University of Iowa, both undergraduate and graduate, for journalism, and became a newspaper reporter during World War II when so many of the men were off fighting. And in very Mildred-like fashion, she just put her foot down and said she was not going to give up her job when they came back. And lo and behold, you know, 50 years later, she was still there at the Toledo Blade. So she was really a tough character. She became a pilot when she was in her late 50s, and she took to chartering planes in South America to explore archaeological ruins. She just was an unbelievable force in the lives of everybody who came into contact with her, I think, and really no nonsense and didn't suffer fools. And Harriet Adams was, you know, a softer character, but she was also just incredibly ambitious. When her father died in 1930, she was the mother of four and had never worked, although she had really wanted to, but it was sort of not what a woman of her class and position was expected to do. And I think that she really saw this as her chance. I mean, she took this company over during the Depression, which would have been very risky for anybody, but especially for a woman, and just decided that she was going to do it and become a CEO. And, you know, she just stuck to it. She had to learn the whole business from scratch. And she really, also like Mildred, she was still working up until, you know, pretty much the day she died. And you know, I think without her, and she has sometimes been overlooked, as Mildred Benson has gotten her credit for being the first Carolyn Keene. But really, without Harriet, the series and the Stratemeyer Syndicate would not have continued. I think, like so many things during the Depression, it would have been very easy for the businesses to die out, and she just wasn't going to let that happen. So, I mean, I really also admire her gumption for just taking on this job at a time when, you know, everything indicated that it was absolutely the wrong thing to do.
Mm, very interesting. We have to wrap up here, but I want to know, what can you tell us about who's writing Nancy Drew today?
I can only tell you that it's Carolyn Keene. I don't know. Beyond that, it's still a very closely guarded secret.
It's a mystery. Well, Melanie, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, it was my pleasure.
Melanie Rahak has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's a critic and a poet. Her essays have appeared in several magazines, including the New York Times Magazine and Vogue. Her poetry has been published in The New Yorker and The Paris Review. Girl Sleuth, Nancy Drew, and the Women Who Created Her is Melanie Rahak's first book. The publisher is Harcourt. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in this afternoon and to the listeners who called in during the conversation this afternoon. We're going to turn the conversation now to some business. Jim Meadows is here with me in the studio. Jim's one of our reporters here at AM 580, and this is the fall membership campaign. And the business at hand is getting people to join the Friends of WILL.
That's right, Celeste. And I was thinking, if this station were a Nancy Drew book, it might be called The Mystery of the Funding Gap. Where are we going to find the money in the face of our government, our traditional funding sources, the government, the University of Illinois, gradually decreasing year by year? It's to the point now where the federal support, the money that everybody expects to pay for public broadcasting, is just 18% of our budget. University of Illinois funding, they own the station, but their funding is only 27% of our operating budget. Well, over the years, we have increasingly turned to you, our listeners, and now you contribute up to 47% of our revenue. That's the level that you hit last year, and we're asking you to help more this year with a call at 217-244-9455, or you can go online at willpledge.org and make your pledge. Allison Davis Wood of WILL-TV is over at Pledge Central, where those calls are coming in.
Yes, Jim, they are coming in. We have reached over $61,000 toward our goal today of $70,000, so I know that we can reach that goal. We also have 98 new members, and we have a goal of 500 new members for this radio drive. So please, if you're enjoying the programming, enjoying listening to all the news about Nancy Drew, any of the great topics that are discussed on the Afternoon Magazine, go to your phone and make a pledge at 217-244-9455. We have volunteers here in Pledge Central, and they'd love to hear from you. It's really easy. They just have a very few questions to ask you, and one of those may be, would you like to pay on your Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express? And that's a quick way for us to use your dollars to get the programming on the air on the radio that you like to hear. You can also make a pledge by going to our website at willpledge.org. Will Pledge is one word. It's very easy to do. Maybe you tune in the evenings and listen to some of the broadcasts that you missed during the day or listen to them. Maybe you're listening to through your computer right now. Well, you can go and make a pledge at willpledge.org. So we're going to get to that $70,000 goal, I know, today, but we can only do it with your support. 244-9455. And I want to remind you that this is Wacky Wednesday, and that means that we have a special gift for you. If you've never made a pledge to WYLL, you will get a $10 gift certificate to World Harvest Foods, which is an incredible value and something I'm sure a lot of people out there listening would really enjoy. So, Jim and Celeste, let's I know we're going to hear from some more listeners of WYLL this afternoon.
Yeah, and you know, I want to get back to the idea of Nancy Drew and the funding gap. You know, only one out of 10 listeners contributes. Now there's a mystery.
That is.
There's a mystery.
Not even Carson Drew, I think, knows the answer to that. But maybe there are some listeners out there who do, and they can call in and give us their answer at 217-244-9455. That's 217-BIG-WILL.
217-244-WILL. And our web address for pledging, willpledge.org. We hope you will. Willpledge, W-I-L-L, pledge.org. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Let's turn our attention now to what happened today in Chicago on the Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you much, Celeste. From the board this afternoon, futures in the wheat pit at 330 high today, the low at 326 and a quarter, settlement price at 327 and three quarters. They were down a penny on the day. The March futures, a 344 and a half high, low at 340 and a quarter. Settlement price at 341 and three quarters. They were down a penny and three quarters. And the May futures in the wheat pit finished a half cent lower, 351 and a half, the high, the low at 48 and a half. A settlement price there at 350 even, and they were down a half cent for the day. July futures in the wheat pit, 357 and a half, the high, the low at 354, settled at 356 and a quarter. Down one quarter. September futures at 363 and a half high, low at 360 and a half, settled at 362 and three quarters, and they finished down a quarter for the day. December corn futures now, 202 and a quarter, the high, the low at 201 and a quarter. Settlement price at 201 and three quarters. They were down a quarter of a cent. The March off a quarter as well. Had a high today of 215 and a quarter, low at 214. Settlement price at $2.14 and a half cents for the March corn. They were once again down a quarter cent for the day. May futures, 223, the high, the low at $2.22. Settlement price at $2.22.5 a bushel, unchanged. July unchanged, too, at $2.29.75 for their final trade at the end of the day. A 230 high, the low at 229 for a penny trading range, ending at 229.75 for the July unchanged. September futures, 238, the high, the low at 37. Settlement price at $2.37.5, and they were up a quarter. Next year's December futures, same sort of thing there. Very narrow trading range, 247.75, the high, the low at 46.75, finished at 247.25 in that penny trading range, up a quarter of a cent for the day. December oats on this Wednesday afternoon, $1.63, the high, the low at 160.5. Settled at $1.62.25. They were up a penny, and the March oats were up a penny and a quarter at $1.70. That was their high, the low at $1.68.25. November beans, $5.90.5, the high, the low at $5.83. A rally at the end of the day settled the beans at $5.89.25, very close to the top end of that range, up 4.75, led by some commercial buying. We're told we'll check on that with Paul Cooley this afternoon during the closing market report. You might recall that last Wednesday after the USDA reports, Paul said that the bottom was in the bean market. It looks like that may be the case. Last week, of course, an outside up week on the charts for the nearby lead option. That would be the November contract. And we'll talk again with Paul this afternoon at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock, during the closing market report. January beans, 602 and a half, the high, low at 595. Settlement price at 601 and three quarters. They were up a nickel. And the March, 610 and a half, the high, the low at 603 and a half. Settled 609 and a half, up 5 and a half. And the May contract, 615 and a half on the high, the low at 608 and a half. A settlement price, 614 and three quarters. They were up 6 cents for the day. July futures, 620, the high, the low at 613 and a half. A settlement price at 619 and a half, up 5 3/4. In the August contract, 618 and a half, the high, the low at 15 and a half. Settlement price at $6.18.5. They were up 6.5. In fact, we'll ask this afternoon to Paul the question of how it was that he changed from bearish to, I don't know whether he's friendly to neutral to bullish, but we'll find that out. Because it came about pretty quickly after that report on Wednesday last week, that I'm sure had most of the decision in the back of his mind. But there were probably a few other factors we'll try to flush out this afternoon with him. Soybean meal now. December contract, 173, the high, the low at 170.30. Settled at 172.20, up 120 in the January meal, 174.80, the high, the low at 172, settled at 174, they were up 120 for the day. December bean oil, 24.56 on the high, the low there at 24.23, settlement price at 24.31, they were down 13. And the January bean oil, 24.78, the high, the low at 24.48, settlement price at 24.58, and they we're down 13. Hey, by the way, if you haven't dialed that number in support of agricultural programming yet, please do so. It's 217-244-9455. That's 217-244-9455. 244-BIG-WILL. 244-BIG-WILL. Do it now. You can get ahead of the game before we get into the closing market report and pledge your financial support to AM 580 Agriculture, bringing you the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Here's Celeste Quinn.
And livestock prices strong once again today. Everything finishing on the upside. October feeder cattle 118 even, the high, the low 116.95, the settlement 117.65, up 37 and a half. November 116.80, the high, the low 115.55, the settlement 116.17 and a half, that up 57 and a half. January feeder cattle 114.35, the high 112.90, the low 114.05, the settlement, that up 92 and a half. October live cattle 90.95, the high 88.80, the low 89.60, the settlement, that up 62 and a half. December live cattle 92.22 and a half, the high 89.87 and a half, the low, the settlement 90.42 and a half, up 47 and a half. December lean hogs, the high today 61.50, the low 60.05, the settlement 61.07 and a half, that up 72 and a half. February 64.40, the high 62.60, the low 63.97 and a half, the settlement, that up 75. April lean hog 64.75, the high 63.55, the low, the settlement 64.67 and a half, that up 52 and a half. May lean hog 65.20, the high 64 even, the low, the settlement 65.12 and a half, that up 80. February pork bellies 89.20, the high 86.50, the low 88.32 and a half, the settlement, that finished up 132 and a half. On Wall Street, the Dow is currently coming up here right now, up 70 points at 10,355. The NASDAQ 22 higher at 2078. The S&P 500 10 higher at 1188.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois. Deferred pricing contracts available this fall. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at lincolnlandagrienergy.com. Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Jason Croft is our technical director today, the producer for the Afternoon Magazine, Harriet Williamson. My name is Celeste Quinn. We're listener-supported WILL, and this is our fall membership campaign. It's through campaigns like this that we find the contributors and the dollars we need to keep our programs on the air. Morning Edition, Focus 580, the Afternoon Magazine, weather reports throughout the day, the Closing Market Report, which is coming up following the news from National Public Radio, Commodity Week on Saturdays, all things considered in the afternoon.